Accession number 9552, reel 19.
Mr. Basil Farah, Reel 19. You're telling me how you came to settle in France.
Yes. Anyhow, I arranged to meet him, and he was there at the Gare Saint-Lazare when I arrived in Paris. Now, this was in December 1920. And I found he was an elderly man. Of course, nowadays, one can have all kinds of ideas of what might transpire, but I was purely innocent in those. It's strange to say, that generation, kids in the infant school know more than young men of my generation when we were young. They do, really. Lots of us were. Others were for more adults. Anyhow, this chap was an elderly chap. And he said, "Where's your luggage?" And then I'd had it registered through. He said, "Well, we'll draw it," and then we've a train to catch. I said, "I thought we lived in Paris." He said, "I told you, in the banlieue." Now, he told me the banlieue, but I didn't know that word, banlieue. The suburb. And he lived in a distance about 10 or 12 miles outside of Paris. Nice little country place. Now, as I say, we'd arrived at the Gare Saint-Lazare room 6 o'clock in the evening in December, so it's dark. And it was snowing. Anyhow, we got my trunk, we got the train to this place, and I found that it was in the country. And in those days, there were no taxis, but there were fiacs, or those closed, I've forgotten what they call them, but like a closed vehicle, horse-drawn. Not a taxi. A fiac is open, really, but this is closed. And I remember in this thing, going along, the horse trotting along, and outside I could see trees, and then we drew up in front of big iron wrought gates, and I could see the house. I thought, "What the devil wants this?" Anyhow, he lived in, it was quite a place he lived in its own grounds, and he went and opened the door. I thought, and he turned round to me, he said, "Now, you think it's strange, but it's Christmas time, and I've allowed the staff," he implied the servants, "they want to be home at Christmas." I said, "Well, who's going to do the cooking then over Christmas?" He said, I can do that all right." Anyhow, went in, showed me the bedroom, magnificently furnished. He lived on the first floor, and the bedroom I was to occupy was above that. Wonderful, beautifully furnished. Off it was a bathroom and toilet and all that kind of thing. Anyhow, we settled in for that day, and I remember going out, and I do remember too, I must, going back, I'll try to say this quickly. Whilst at the Pecos, the street clerk, a fellow used to get tips for racing, and the latter end, and they seemed to be, we seemed to be extremely lucky, until there was a strike, a railway strike, and it stopped racing. And then when it restarted, we started again, and we'd backed a horse, Pomme de Terre was the name, Pomme de Terre, three or four times and lost. Now, I went out, I mentioned that because when in Garche, I didn't know that the race course of Saint-Cloud was within a mile. On the Sunday, having a walk out, the Sunday of my arrival, I saw a race course, and I went in, it was Saint-Cloud. And, of course, in those days, they had the Paris Mutuel, long before we did. And I'd just got a programme, and I saw Pomme de Terre. And I had just time to go and place a bet, 5 francs. The race had started, just as I'd placed my bet. And I had time to go to the winning post, but the horse was there before me. And I won! That was the debut. Anyhow, that's just by the way. Monday, the week came, the Christmas holiday was over, and I wondered what to do, whether to go on. And then, of all things, a telegram arrived for me. Now, nobody in England knew my address, but this telegram was from Paris. I was mystified, and I opened it. Please report 9:30 on a state of the date, the Monday, whatever it was, for interview. Well, I was... The man, incidentally, his name was... He told me to call him Charles, and he called me Monsieur Basile. This is a bit less formal, you see. So I turned to him, I said, do you know anything about this then? You must do. He said, yes. I'm not surprised. He said, when I saw your advertisement in the press, I looked through the situation's vacant column, and I saw one asking for a bilingual secretary to the manager of a shipping office. Bilingual secretary? I thought, well, I've nothing to lose. I went along, and I was one of about six or seven applicants. All the others were French. Now, it was the Royal Mail Steam Packet Company, and it was the manager there wanted a bilingual secretary. There were two managers. The French law was there to have a French manager and an English one. And the English one wanted a bilingual secretary. Well, I was last in for interview. The manager, who had recently come out of the British Army, he was a major in the artillery. I had recently come out of the British Army. I was an ex-wounded soldier, pensioned on account of wounds. Therefore, immediately favourably towards me, providing, of course, I filled in the requirements. Didn't ask me with regard to French. He took that for granted, that I was bilingual. He said, you know shorthand? I said, yes, sir. He said, what's your speed? I said, well, you'll appreciate, sir, that having recently left the army, I've had very little, some time since I had occasion to really use it. I couldn't tell you the speed now. Now, he said, that's all right. And he got a shorthand typist book, gave me the pencil, and he stood at the side of me. He took into account what I'd said, that I had done the shorthand for some time, and he just dictated at an ordinary conversational way. Well, I'd learned French grammar, I knew everything. It was copybook shorthand I was doing. He knew shorthand. He'd been... In those days, in offices, even managers, you start at the bottom, and that was one of the normal accomplishments, shorthand. He knew it. Oh, he said, yes, you know shorthand, all right. He said, in a couple of weeks, you'll regain your speed. Your normal speed. And I started there. And I found that we got on marvellously well, but he was a chappie who... liked to work on his own. We'd go out in the afternoon. He'd take me out. He was married to a French title lady. And on one occasion, we went to the Chambre des Députés. He got a ticket to, as you can in the Stangers Gallery at the House of Parliament. He got a ticket. We went, things like that. And we'd get back to the office at 5 o'clock when everybody was leaving, and then he'd start dictating, and I'd be there till midnight. And I'd do the typing the following morning, of course. But about half past seven, he'd say, well, we've had to... All I got out of it, it didn't pay overtime, but he took me out and we went to a posh restaurant and had a pucker meal. Then back to the office to finish his dictation. But I couldn't get a rise out of him. I started on a very nominal salary. But sufficient to... I must return to this other chap. We'd agreed terms, and they were really economic. I mean, I found out that, now to explain this, why this old chap, he was a lonely old man. He took in one guest. It was something to occupy his mind. He'd retired from business many, many years before. He'd had this house built, and he'd no servants. He did the gardening, did the cooking. And I won't go into his whole history because it doesn't concern the man. But it's remarkable, nevertheless. And prior to me being there, he'd had an Englishman who married. So that was the end of that. He couldn't have his wife there. As a matter of fact, and he was like lots of Frenchmen, very French are inclined, whatever they say, they're more xenophobic than we are. We are getting used to it now. We're very cosmopolitan, although in the olden times we didn't like foreigners very much. But French, at the bottom of them, they're naturally against foreigners. And with regard to England, it's kind of a love-hate. They used to admire us, but they used to hate us. They'd never think of... They always thought of avenging Sedan, but never thought of avenging Waterloo. The thing is, the hatred is, we've devastated France. We claim the crown of France. There was the 100 Years' War, and we've gone against them in all there. They discovered they were the first in India. We kicked them out, except they kept Pondicherry, but we had India. They were the first in Canada, and we've gone against them right through the history. That is, it's inherent with them, their dislike of the English. And he was one. I've gone to a great thing to explain him. And I said to him, but why do you... My predecessor was English, I'm English, why do you take us then as a guest? He said, well, incidentally, he was there's a word for it. Not a misanthrope, is a misanthropic. Hated everybody.
Misanthrope,
yeah. Yes. But with the one, I'll tell you how he acted. He said, if I had a Frenchman, he'd be going to see them every weekend, or they'd be coming to see him. You're English, you can't be nipping over to England every, and I don't expect any of your relations to be coming here. Now, that was that.
So you worked at this shipping company?
Yes. And I eventually began picking up, improving my French. Now, I'll return again to the old chap in Garche. He acted just like a valet. Brought my cup of coffee in the morning to bed. Whilst I was shaving, he'd be preparing the breakfast, and just like a servant. And at the weekends, I was quiet in the garden there, and I was studying French, trying the grammar and improving my vocabulary. So it helped me considerably. But I could, now we'll go back to the job. I couldn't get a rise out of him, and I found too that where I'd gone to live was almost an English colony. Quite a lot of English people were living there, and they all travelled first class. And this Monsieur Charles pointed out that I had to travel first class as an Englishman. So in those days, I bought a yearly season ticket first class. God knows what it costs now. I don't know what it costs. And there it was. And I made the acquaintance of an English boy of my own age in the village where I was living. And of course he introduced me at home, and his father was the chief cashier of the Cunard line in Paris. And one evening he knew that I was a bit dissatisfied. I wasn't getting enough money, in other words. And he said, well, now the father, on the occasion of one of the visits, he said to me, he said, we're opening a freight office. One of our men, Mr. Hicks, who has been with the company some years, is about 2 or 3 years older than you. He didn't do any military service, and there's possibly a good chance, the fact is, that because of his health. And he's opening a freight office, and he'll want staff. If you could get in, you'd probably might even get his job in time. His health kept him out of the army. But there was a policy. English companies didn't poach each other's staff. He said, but you'll have to get a letter from your manager releasing you. Now, as I told you, there were two managers, the French and the English, and that undercurrent was always there. The Frenchman objected, didn't like the Englishman. Now, my boss, the English fella, he was going to do a tour of Spain, business tour, and I had to arrange all the correspondence and all that. And whilst he was away, I approached the other manager, told him I'd been offered a job in the Cunard, but would he give me a letter releasing me? He was only too glad to do his colleague, and that's the turn. He gave me the letter, took it to the Cunard, and when the other fella came back, it was too late. He was furious. Tilbury, Major Tilbury, it was. And that's how I started in the Cunard. That would be in... Now, I went over there 21 in beginning of April, March or April 22, I started with the Cunard. Yes, I did 38 and a half years with them when I retired in 1960.
Now, you were in France right up to the start of the Second World War.
Yes.
During the whole of the period after the First World War, was there anything you noticed about the French attitude to the war, the First World War, and also their attitude to the British involvement in the First World War? Is there anything that comes to mind?
Yes. They suffered terribly, more than we did. In the first place, part of their country was occupied, which we didn't. No. Devastated. And their losses were... ours were nearly 1 million, but theirs were 1.5 million dead. And Verdun, in fact, during the war itself, there was even a mutiny in the French army, not of regiments, but of divisions. And their attitude towards the war was different to the British. We'd fought, but we hadn't been occupied, and we hadn't suffered like they'd suffered. And they were for reparations for Germany paying. In fact, they'd been invaded twice, practically a generation, in 1870 and in 1914, in a generation. And so they had a certain hatred. We used to refer to the Germans as Jerry. Well, Jerry wasn't quite offensive, but they had that Bosch, a bit of an offensive sound about Stellenbosch. And there was a... our policy, we seemed to go against their policy after the war. We didn't support them against the Germans when the Germans occupied the Saar and the Rhineland and things like that, and we seemed to be more pro-German. There did become a certain resentment, so that when the Second War broke out, they did not want war. And furthermore, there was a party in France, a right-wing party, as there was in England, like we had in England, mostly. They had a right-wing party there. And France, although there's a big left-wing section of the French population in politics, socialists, they all said they're communists. And they... French bourgeoisie, in the main, in the middle class, in the establishment, were scared stiff of the communists, because they remembered after the Franco-Prussian War the Commune. You know about that. Well, that was a terrible civil war, and the French bourgeoisie were afraid of that. So they didn't want war with Germany. And
when did it first become apparent to you that Hitler's Germany posed a threat, that there was likely to be another war? Did you follow this sort of thing?
From the time of... even then, I read Mein Kampf when he published it, the French edition, which was unexposed. The English edition was exposed, you know, but the French wasn't. And in that, its programme, which he carried out to the letter practically, at the beginning, I didn't take it seriously. But I must explain this. I've never been, because of my life, politically, neither one way or the other. I lived abroad and never voted, because I was a foreigner. I was too young in England, therefore I had no political opinions. So politics didn't interest me. And it was not until late that I personally saw, because people did see come in, it was pretty obvious, but in 38, then after Munich, you could see come in at Munich. The French had partially mobilised. It was partial mobilisation, and they maintained it until full mobilisation. Because that affected our staff, because some of our French fellows had to be mobilised. And it was not until then. But during the period, the old period, there were periods when they were anti-British times because of our attitude towards them.
Did that show itself in the way people treated you?
No. You could have friends. Although, a Frenchman, as an Englishman, there's certain things inherent. Now, our great friends, I remember when we went off the gold standard, he was the man who did that sculpture of my son then I've got his caricature and the photo he did of the president there. I remember when we were great friends. When we went off the gold standard, that evening, coming from work, I met him. And with glee, what sacre livre, Stellan, eh? gloating over we'd gone off the gold standard. It was there, the feeling, anti-British. But you made good friends, as I can prove, as proved to me during the war. When we come to that, I'll tell you about them. Anyhow, France mobilised, and in 39, it was approaching. I must tell you again, the English unknown soldier is in Westminster Abbey, isn't it? The French unknown soldier is buried underneath the Arc de Triomphe. Every night, now I suppose it still goes on, but I'm talking about the time I lived there, right up to the time I retired. From the time he was buried there, every night, incidentally, there's a plaque there with the sacred flame. There's a ceremony every night of a symbolic rekindling of the flame. And each section of the French ex-service people, all over France and Paris, they notified it when it's their turn to come and that ceremony. They're taking up the Champs-Élysées, there's the Saint-Rémy, that is the last post and all that, and it's quite a thing. The 4th of August was the date of our entry into the war, was reserved for the Paris section of the British Legion. And so on the 4th of August at quarter to six, we'd assemble in the Champs-Élysées and have a French band. We'd march up the Champs-Élysées with a French band in front of us, and it was our ceremony. We'd rekindle the flame. Now, the 4th of August, 1939, was coming. And I rather fancy it was a governmental inspired to sort of, you might say, refresh the Entente Cordiale, to make something of this 4th of August, rekindling the flame. So I suppose they more or less requested the French ex-service association to invite the British Legion to send over representatives to take part in this ceremony from their different sections. So about 100 or so legionnaires from England, from different parts, different sections in England, went over. Not only did the legionnaires go over, but the guards' band went over in full ceremonials, and they went over for a long weekend. We of the Paris branch acted as a cicerone. that is a French, is English expression, cicerone, is it? Well, a guide, if you like. So, like, we spoke French and intermediaries help along. They were invited, taken to the chateau country. We went out to Versailles, visited the chateau, and fed magnificent. And they were put up in hotels, first class hotels, not at the no expense to them. But the final thing was that Sunday we were going to march up the Champs Elysees to rekindle the flame. So, in the morning, we were taken out to Fontainebleau. We were taken out to Fontainebleau. Visited the chateau, and we had lunch there, the palais. Came in. Then, we'd march up the Champs Elysees. With our Guards band in front ceremonials, the Guard Republican band, and another French band. And it was quite a do. Watch, march up the Champs Elysees and kindle the flame. We came down. Incidentally, I must relate something which, again, I'm not exaggerating. During the actual ceremony, a thunderstorm broke out and a torrential pour of rain, a downpour of rain, absolutely sopping wet through. And I, truthfully, I thought to myself, I do remember, is this an omen? When the ceremony had stopped, the rain stopped. And we marched down, by the time, down the Champs-Élysées, when we got to the Pont d'Alexandre there, we turned, right, I don't know whether you know Paris, and marched into Les Invalides. Now, the Grand Les Invalides was a place like for the Chelsea pensioners. But there's the church there where Napoleon's tomb is, and it's also a military museum. And in the courtyard, we laid out a banquet. It was a banquet, real. The food was extraordinary. In one corner we got our guards band, and in the other corner the French Republican guards band. And it was a really, and the head table, of course, with all the government officials, generals, ministers, and we. It was a wonderful evening. But towards the end, when we were having the coffee, we were at tables, about five or six to a table. And there was a voice behind me, exclaiming, Légionnaire, c'est toi qui parle français? Is there a Légionnaire Légionnaire that speaks French? So I turned around and I said, I thought he wanted some assistance. Something wrong? I said, yes, what can I do to help? He said, will you come along, please? So, as we, I said, well, what's the matter? I thought there was some little incident that he wanted some help. He said, well, we'd like you to, as an old legionnaire, to speak on behalf of your fellow legionnaires to the French. I said, what? To speak to the French? What can I say? This was after the meal,